I was talking to a late clinical stage biopharma CEO just yesterday who laughed out loud when I asked him if his company was manufacturing clinical material in-house or outsourcing. He asked me almost incredulously if any emerging bio companies are in a position to manufacture in-house. So I took this guffaw of his in stride, but the truth is that I talk to emerging bio CEOs just about every day of the week, and I guess a lot of folks would be surprised at how many of them are actually manufacturing in their own facilities. Today's guest on the Business of Biotech is one such CEO. Dr. Ulf Hanelius is joining me today from Stockholm, where he leads Diamyd Medical, a company that is in phase 2B clinical development with an antigen-specific immunotherapy for the treatment of autoimmune diabetes. Diamyd is also in phase 1-2 with a regenerative and immunomodulatory therapy for the treatment of autoimmune diabetes and type 2 diabetes. So today we're going to discuss the manufacturing strategy of those therapeutics at Diamyd. Dr. Hanelius earned his MS in biochemistry from the University of Helsinki, his PhD in molecular biology from Karolinska Institute, and his MBA from the Stockholm School of Economics before diving into the business of biotech. Dr. Hanelius, welcome to the show. I apologize. I'm sure I'm butchering your name. I probably didn't say Karolinska Institute correctly, so I'll give you an opportunity to correct the pronunciations for me.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I think you did a great job with the name, both mine and with Karolinska. If you really want to say it in a Swedish way, it's Karolinska. But I think Karolinska sounds much more international, so that's perfect.
Oh, that's perfect. I'll leave that to you. So I want to get into your background a little bit before we get into the meat of the conversation around the manufacturing strategy at Diamyd. You spent, looking at your resume, your CV, you spent several years in research at the Institute and the University Hospital. And it looks as though your career sort of took this hard turn from research to the business side of biopharma somewhere around 2011. What was the catalyst for making that move?
Yeah, obviously, in retrospect, it's much easier to go and connect sort of the dots, just like Steve Jobs said. It's only now you can connect what happened and why am I here today. So I spent many years in an academic setting, but I think from the very beginning, I always had a bit more of a yearning to go over to the business side, but the opportunity hadn't presented itself. So I stayed and did my PhD and then a postdoc and these things. But then I think the catalyst now going back is actually when I had an opportunity to spend 1 month in Silicon Valley as part of a Swedish governmental program. So if you were a student, you could apply for this program, and then you were sent for 1 month to Silicon Valley, placed in a startup company. And then you could also mingle around and visit like Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, all these fantastic places. So I think really that month in Silicon Valley was kind of a catalyst for me to go from just thinking about maybe doing something else to really that was the catalyst saying, well, I just need to do something else here. And I was in parallel with that, I was doing an MBA education as well here in Stockholm. So I think with that MBA program, which was very inspirational, and then this catalyst going to Silicon Valley and visiting all these large companies and working as an intern at Innovation Games. It was called not a gaming company, but serious games, workshops. How do you get different stakeholders to work together, prioritize things, do market research strategy, but in a very innovative way? I think that was really the catalyst that made me quit academia and just jump over and start my own company. And that's how I then started working first as a consultant in my own company, mostly within life sciences, but other industries as well. And then I got this opportunity to join Diamyd Medical a few years later.
Yeah. Yeah. So you sort of got bit by the entrepreneurial bug and flexed that muscle a little bit before joining Diamyd. So what was the precursor to taking the CEO's position at Diamyd?
Yeah. So I applied for a position. It was an open position for a business development manager. So I applied for that position because it was perfect. It both had the business aspect, which I like, but also you need to understand life sciences and molecular biology in order to, obviously, to sell a biotech product, you need to understand the science as well. So it was like perfect for me. And I knew the company from before as well, not in depth, but I knew about it because it had a long history in Sweden. So I applied for that position and I got that position. And about half a year later, I got the offer to become the CEO, which I was a bit surprised, but I jumped on that opportunity. And I understand now in retrospect that it was actually the company had the purpose of employing a business development manager was to check if that individual could maybe be the potential future CEO. So I didn't know that at the time when I got the business development manager position, but yeah, that was the whole purpose of that position, actually.
When was that? When did you join the company?
Yeah, that's 5.5 years ago. So that means, well, comes complicated math now. So almost no. Exactly 5.5 years ago.
That's perfect. No. Yeah, you look young. You look young. How old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
No, it's no problem. It's these Zoom filters, I think. But it's, I'm 45.
45, okay. Yeah, yeah. Me too. You look much younger than I do, though. yeah. So tell us about Diamyd. I want to learn about the mission, why there's this focus on developing a type 1 diabetes vaccine and regenerative therapeutics. But I'd like you to tackle that question, sort of framing things up in the context of what Diamyd was when you joined the company and what it's become in these past 5.5 years.
Yeah. So first, like the whole purpose of the company is to find a cure for type 1 diabetes. That's how the company started. So when the founder's youngest daughter got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, making a long story short, traveled around the world trying to find something that could be a potential cure, licensed the rights and started the company. And that's then been taken all through the preclinical stage to clinical stage and partnership with J&J in times and then almost at market, but then the phase 3 back in 10 years ago didn't meet the primary endpoint. So, but when I joined the company, all these things had happened and the company was at the stage where small pilot trials were ongoing. So the phase 3 hadn't met the primary endpoint. The technology was handed back by J&J and the scientific advisory board. Our network took the decision, well, there is an effect here, and it's very safe. We do see that there is an effect. We just need to enhance the effect. So how do we do that? So let's start smaller pilot trials with different combinations, different ways of administering the drug to see what is the path forward, basically. So these things were ongoing when I joined the company 5.5 years ago. And it was right at the time when we started to get the first signals from these small trials to really get the first results. So we were able to start to see, well, what looks most promising and what doesn't look promising. So about a year after I joined, when I was CEO, we saw the results from a small trial where the drug was administered directly into the superficial lymph node. So rather than underneath the skin, which is the normal way, we went directly to the target where actually the immune reaction happens in the lymph node. We administered directly there. And those results looked so promising that we decided to raise capital to start a phase 2B trial, a larger placebo-controlled trial based on those results. And that was very important. So that was also the first time when I was involved in raising capital for the company. Mm-hmm. And the purpose was that we chose the direction for the company. This is the product that we will take to market. Going from 6 small pilot trials, we chose the direction and sort of raised the capital to support that development.
Okay, very cool. So tell me about the therapeutic itself, if you will, and maybe discuss how the immunotherapeutic approach that Diamyd takes is different from what's currently available on the market.
Yeah, so today there are no disease-modifying therapies approved for type 1 diabetes. We've had insulin for exactly 100 years now, and that's obviously was a revolution for the diabetes field, and it has saved millions and millions of lives. But it's a maintenance therapy. It's something you take for the rest of your life. Too much insulin will kill you, But you need to take insulin in order to regulate your blood sugars and basically not die. But ever since, well, during these 100 years, the industry has been very good at obviously optimizing insulin, developing devices that can to automate things. So today we have maintenance therapies and devices that make the lives of diabetics easier. But there's nothing that addresses the underlying disease. And that's what we are doing. So we are really trying to go at the core of the disease and reprogram the immune system so that it stops destroying the insulin-producing cells. And in the best case, we could even turn the disease progression so that you start going towards something that could resemble a cure. And what we are then specifically, we use a single component like a protein that we know that the immune system targets. It belongs in the body. It's expressed by the insulin-producing cells, but for some reason it's recognized as something foreign by the immune system. And we try to create like a reverse vaccine. We present the same protein to the immune system, but in a way that it realizes that, well, this is actually nothing that is dangerous, in order to, that it stops the immune attack. And in this way, preserves the insulin production that is left.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you, so you mentioned one of your first tasks early on as CEO was to raise some capital. So I want to ask you some questions about that. First of all, what was your comfort level with that role, as CEO? And then, tell us about how you've funded, you know, how you've sort of matured that, that funding strategy and funded the growth that you've seen over the past 10 years. Cause it's been quite, you know, quite substantial.
Yeah. So, well, the comfort level, obviously, in the beginning, because I was offered the role only after half a year in business development. And it's nothing that I had planned for. So I didn't apply for a CEO role. I was suddenly offered by the founder, actually. But I saw it as a great opportunity, and I had a lot of support from the founder, who also was the previous CEO. But in the beginning, I think since we are a publicly traded company and there are a lot of rules and regulations when it comes to this, what you can and can't say, I think in the beginning, you're a bit paranoid that you will say something, the wrong thing. So you said much less than you wanted to say, just in case.
Sure.
But that's something that you learn over the time. The more you understand, you know the company at its core, you know exactly what we are doing, why we are doing it. And then you also know exactly what is confidential, what isn't confidential, what have we press released, what haven't we press released. Then you start feeling very comfortable in knowing, you know, exactly what you can say, what you can't say. So that's something you grow into. But I think for me, it was most important. In retrospect, I'm very happy that I accepted the position because it's very easy that in those cases, you just say, well, maybe it's a bit too much responsibility. So thank you, but no, thank you.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm very glad I took that opportunity.
Excellent. So as you work through that that funding exercise and the subsequent IPO, excuse me, was the intention all along to take that money that you're raising and leverage the IPO so that you could build a manufacturing facility or develop a manufacturing facility, or did that kind of, I guess I'm curious how the strategy sort of aligned with your manufacturing strategy.
No. So the first capital we raised, that was specifically to support the phase 2B trial that we started in 2017 in Europe, in many European countries. And at that time, the manufacturing was outsourced, like is very common for virtual biotech companies. The decision to internalize the manufacturing was taken when our previous manufacturer, who was in the US, they were acquired by a big pharma company. And then we understood as well sometime later that they were unable to manufacture for us, to continue as a contract manufacturer, basically. Because they acquired our manufacturer to get access to a certain drug candidate that was being developed. Mm. And then we obviously had the choice to see, well, will we continue outsourcing? I mean, there are other contract manufacturers that understand the technology we are using. We knew about them and had a lot of contact with them. Or do we internalize? So that was a strategic question that we were sort of discussing internally with the board. And I think the catalyst why we internalized it, it was the COVID pandemic. So when that happened, we realized that there's a lot of disruption happening in the logistic chains globally. A lot of these manufacturers got governmental orders to start focusing their prioritizing COVID vaccine production. And as a small biotech, we realized that there's a high risk that if we would go with a large contract manufacturer, that they would call us a bit later and say, well, we need to prioritize this other order we got, so timelines will be delayed. And that's why we decided to actually find our own manufacturing facility and start up the manufacturing on our own to really get full control so that it wouldn't happen again that we need to, again, change manufacturer, because it takes time, it costs money, and it's very disruptive. So this time we didn't want that to happen again, and we need to control the situation.
Yeah. So I want to linger on sort of the physical aspects of that manufacturing space for a minute. What did you have to start with when you decided to pull back and go in-house? Was it starting from a blank slate? We need to go find a facility. We need to procure equipment. What did that sort of look like?
Pretty much a blank slate. Obviously, we had a lot of knowledge about the manufacturing, the process in itself. It's a very well-established process, and it has actually been manufactured by several different manufacturers. So we knew the process, that it works. It's a robust process. But other than that, it was a blank slate. We didn't have a facility. We didn't have any, obviously, manufacturing equipment at that time. So we went to, the first thing was to find the manufacturing facility. And that was kind of a stroke of luck. So actually our founder, he was reading a newspaper and he saw an ad for a manufacturing facility in the northern part of Sweden that looked promising, that had been a GMP manufacturing facility for other companies previously. Oh. And it was available. So basically a phone call and that's it. We had our manufacturing facility. And then we hired our facility manager, who was living in that area, who one of our board members knew her. So we already had a good reference. And that's kind of the start. You had the facility, the first person in place to start figuring out everything like the equipment, the employees, all of these things. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge amount that has happened. Actually, this was about a year ago. And it's not trivial to start a manufacturing facility. That's obviously, you understand why it's common to outsource, because it's high barriers to enter.
Right.
But that also means once you do it, you sit in a very exclusive position as well. You really, truly build value. You go beyond only patents and data. You have actually invest into something tangible.
Yeah. 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 That's certainly a commitment. Was the facility equipped at all, or did you need to sort of outfit it with equipment, do some retrofitting?
Yeah, we did outfit it. So it had the clean rooms and all the framework was in place, but obviously each process is quite unique and we use a specific process, which is based on insect cells that are infected by baculoviruses. So it's very difficult to just take a facility and just sort of input your process. You always need to modify and tailor things. So we had the facility was in place, but all the equipment, everything need to be acquired, put in place, like the small scale, large scale. Some of the rooms need to be refitted or some walls need to be moved and stuff like this to really make sure that the process fits within that. Those premises. So,
yeah. As you were building the facility out, so you're in clinic and you're obviously manufacturing clinical supply. How much foresight was required or applied, I guess, to think forward? Right? Like, will you be in a position? Should you see success and reach commercialization, will you be in a position with this facility to manufacture at scale for commercial purposes, or is that sort of a road yet to be charted?
Well, we've obviously done the reality check there, looking at the yield from our process. How much protein do we get out of the process per batch? How much do we need to when we formulate? And then when we looking at the number of patients that could, in theory, be treated year one, year two, year three, when we go to market, mm-hmm. To really make sure that we don't have undercapacity. In the best case, we have overcapacity. And the good thing for us is that we have a pretty good yield, and we use a tiny amount of the protein when we treat. So we have a very good comfort level in that this facility, at least in theory, would be able to cover the global needs, at least the first year when you go to market.
Yeah.
But that's obviously a very important factor in to make sure that we don't just invest into something and then realize a few years later that, wait a minute, we need to establish a second facility as well, or a third one.
The business of biotech is brought to you in partnership with Cytiva. Together, we're committed to helping the leaders of new and emerging biopharma companies navigate the financial, organizational, human resources, and regulatory waters you'll encounter on your way from discovery to the clinic and beyond. Check out a host of useful resources for biotech leaders at Cytiva's Emerging Biotech Accelerator at cytivalifesciences.com/emerging biotech. That's cytivalifesciences.com/emerging biotech. Let's talk about the organizational changes required. So maybe paint a picture for me in terms of personnel, for instance, what Diamyd looked like when you're outsourcing from an expertise and personnel standpoint, and what sort of had to transition and change when you took manufacturing in-house. What had to be, from a personnel standpoint, had to be added?
So when I started in the company, so five and a half years ago, we were about 5-6 individuals in the company, mm-hmm. which is pretty standard for a virtual biotech company. I mean, you as long as you sit on the financial strategy, business development strategy, and the project management, then you can outsource a lot of the things to CROs and consultants. And we did grow with a few individuals on the clinical side before the manufacturing decision, because we are highly focused on clinical trials, and it's one of our core areas of expertise is really to run clinical trials. So that's something where we are very, very strong. But when we took the decision to manufacture, obviously we quickly, not quite doubled the amount of employees, but going from a facility manager to getting 2-3 like more laboratory individuals quite quickly in place to be involved when you choose the equipment, install the equipment, start doing the lab work, all these things. Then getting the quality responsible person. So all these individuals that need to be in place who understand quality control, all the SOPs need to be written. So it's not only lab work, it's everything highly regulated. So we did quite quickly employ many individuals with both the laboratory experience and the quality experience and GMP experience. And we were very lucky that we found actually the right competence in the northern part of Umeå, because this is all happening during a COVID pandemic where we are all very restricted to travel. There are still a few of the employees I haven't met physically in the manufacturing facility. But yeah. We are very lucky that we found the right competence in that area of Sweden. Mm-hmm. But we were a bit worried that maybe we need to go beyond, and how easy will it be for individuals to move during a pandemic to a different part of the country or even from abroad to Sweden. We've been very lucky there.
Were there other pharma companies in that area that you could draw from, or academic centers? What was sort of the, you know?
Yes. So there's Umeå, which is in the north of Sweden. It's one of the main university cities in Sweden. So that means that there's a very good basis for highly educated individuals in the life science area. And you also have not maybe huge amount of biotech companies, but you do have these startup companies, and actually the company that is formulating our drug. So when you go from the drug product from the drug substance to the drug product, that it's a half governmental biotech company that does formulations. They are actually right in the neighbor with our facility. That's one of the larger players in Sweden. So there's obviously, it's one of the places in Sweden where we find the right kind of competence. And we've been able to really draw on that competence to get the right people into the company.
Obviously, it's a resource, capital, time intensive undertaking. Who had to be on board, or maybe who perhaps had to be lobbied to get on board to make the decision a reality? So I guess take me through that process. What are the, you know, what was the board's perspective? Were there any roadblocks, any objections, and how did you overcome them?
So it was, we knew that we had two opportunities. We could either continue outsourcing, and we had a few top candidates. We knew which manufacturers we would go with in that case, and they would have been able to do the job. And then we had the other opportunity to go insource. And I can say it wasn't an easy choice. I mean, for me, it wasn't like obvious that we should insource. It was a lot of discussions we had internally because this was a very important decision. But I think it was the turning point when you truly got alignment in the whole board and management was when the COVID pandemic was a reality. Yeah. That kind of made people rethink, saying, well, we know that this manufacturing process, it's been transferred several times during the history of the company. Every time it's a big hassle, a disruption. Yeah. Now we have a pandemic that we don't know. I mean, this was in the beginning of pandemic. We didn't really know how long will it take, what will happen. But we knew that it's a true risk. It's a risk we can't really manage because it's not only us. And that was, I think, where you got this alignment. Everyone realized, even if you previously had been on a different mind that, no, we should outsource because that's a normal way of doing. We should focus on our what we do best, like clinical development. Mm-hmm. And when that happened and you realize what it could mean, that's when you got the alignment. Everyone was on board. Let's go for internal manufacturing.
Does it up the stakes at all to a certain degree around, you know, sort of this mentality that, hey, we've made this big investment. We've got this overhead now. We've got this, you know, the cost of keeping the lights on, if you will. That sort of ratchets up our expectation at all. Is there any sort of sense around that?
Well, right now, when I think about it, it's more, we see it more like now we are becoming like a true, like more integrated biopharmaceutical company, if you can say a true company. That's mm-hmm. the right way of saying it. And it's exciting to see how we are growing that. And to when you also hear the individuals who are in the manufacturing facility, when they are explaining about what they're doing every day, that it's something truly tangible. They are building a long-term value. So I think it's, for us, I think, and since we are now moving into phase three development, and we have drug in place for the whole phase three, which is very important as well, that we are not dependent on getting the facility in place, GMP certified, getting the GMP batches out to do a clinical trial. No, we have already all the drug in place for the phase three trial. The most important thing is obviously we get everything in place, GMP certifications, product from that place in time when we go to market, because obviously the manufacturing is a big part of the marketing approval. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously that doesn't become a bottleneck for us, that we have to wait for the manufacturing until we can apply for marketing approval. But the timelines look favorable to us, given that we are, the phase three is going to start this year, Europe and US. That's obviously a large trial that will go on for several years. We do see that there could be an opportunity for us potentially to go earlier to market as well, to get some accelerated approval. Mm-hmm. And then we need to make sure that the manufacturing is in place for that, but that's still some time to go there.
You've alluded to several benefits of having manufacturing in-house, you know, around the ownership of the project, the personnel who are deeply involved, the clinical expertise, the supply, you know, and assurance that the supply is there for phase three. What would you say are the biggest the greatest of those benefits. You know, if I mentioned in my, as we sort of set the conversation up, this conversation I had yesterday with a guy who's just incredulous, you know, that I would even ask, what would you tell that guy? Hey, let me tell you, there are some benefits and here they are.
Yeah. First, I would say that I perfectly understand also that perspective. It's not a obvious thing to do. It's much more normal to outsource because it's simpler. You focus on the core, your core strength, and then you outsource everything else. But I think manufacturing historically, maybe in the biotech pharma industry, has been, at least for biotech companies, it's been something that is ongoing in the background. Or if you think from an investor perspective, you focus on the clinical development, the clinical results, all these things, and it's sort of taken for a given that manufacturing is happening. But pharma isn't like a manufacturing heavy industry compared to automobiles, for example, where manufacturing is at the front. That's what you see, look at. Mm-hmm. In pharma, it's something that's happening behind the scenes. Until now, I think with the COVID pandemic, everyone is talking about manufacturing of vaccines, and you have shortage of vaccine and disruptions in these, and you have manufacturing facilities that are FDA is saying that, well, these batches don't conform to what we think, you need to close this manufacturing facility, all these things. Suddenly manufacturing is top of mind, and you also see, like in the States, I know that these huge manufacturing companies, kind of startup companies with huge amount of capital behind them, are starting up now because everyone realizes the importance of manufacturing. And that's why I think this is now changing, going from an obvious choice to outsource to something that it's not obvious that each country will, that if you are, for example, situated in Sweden, that you will have access to a manufacturing in the US all the time. If a pandemic hits, borders are closed, suddenly you sit there without anything. So, for example, you should have a national strategy for vaccine manufacturing, which a lot of countries are thinking about now. But I think companies also need to think about what's the backup strategy if there are these disruptive events that we can't get access to our active component for a year or two. What happens then? So what are you willing to risk and what aren't you willing to risk?
Yeah. At the same time, you know, you talk about disruption, like the pandemic, for instance. And obviously, we've covered extensively supply chain disruptions and consumables shortages and difficulty, you know, accessing everything from, you know, API to hard goods, if you will, right? Glass, vials, so on and so forth. When you bring your efforts in-house, that's kind of on you. I mean, there's a certain degree of you've got one throat to choke if you're working with a CDMO and they're coming up short. Hey, you know, it's tough out there, but you got to get this done for us.
Yeah.
Has that been a challenge at all? Has the supply chain challenged your in-house manufacturing efforts?
Well, currently not, but it's obviously something that we are very well aware of, that the timelines now, especially right now, they're much longer than they are used to, because partly there's kind of a herding mentality. A lot of people realize that we don't know for how long this pandemic will ongoing. So you sort of buy up a lot of consumables. But that's something that we really need to also, this long-term planning is important. When the facility is in place, it should serve the market to make sure that we plan ahead. We understand how many batches do we need to maybe have, like in capacity, like we have some inventory stored up in case, should it be for a half a year inventory or 1 year inventory for the protein. The protein has a very good lifetime when it's in the freezers. Mm-hmm. We need to have some kind of a overcapacity there in case there's a disruption again. We know that, well, we have protein in place for a year or two. So these things, obviously, we need to, that's something new for us to think about, which previously that's someone else's problem. We are just a paying customer. Now it's on us to really start thinking about long-term planning. It's easier for us, I would assume, than for a CDMO, because they have many different customers, many different products, and they need to sort of prioritize and between everything. We have currently a single protein that the facility is going to produce. So it's everything is prioritized around that one. So it's a bit easier, an easier equation for us. Sure. But it's very important, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, so I asked you about the greatest benefits that you're realizing. Let me flip that coin over and pose the question this way. Let's say your brother is the CEO of an emerging biopharma, and he's considering building a manufacturing facility and insourcing his manufacturing effort. You love your brother. You want to give him the best advice. What are you going to tell him to look out for? What's been a drag? What's been a, you know, oh man, like this is the, I guess the downside of the decision we made.
Well, it's obviously, it's a financial question as well. To insource something, it means more investments, in upfront. Then again, you invest into yourself. You don't invest into someone else's company. So you sort of retain much more of that value that you're investing. But it takes a bit longer. It's a longer startup when you build something on your own. And you will always realize that it's more complicated than you thought in the beginning, which is probably good because it's good to be a bit naive when you go into new things. If you knew everything that will go on, you will probably never do anything. But it's, I would say that, I mean, look at the finances, look at the long-term picture. Obviously, look at the what's the alternative investment? How many CDMOs are out there that know your technology? Make sure that you have those contacts. You maybe negotiate with them to understand what it would cost, how they will do it, all these things, to, that you have the best possible decision support, basically, when you take your decision, that you know the options. Then it's an informed decision. But it's not a simple decision. There's probably no true decision. The most important thing for us and for any company in this kind of situation, to take that decision. The worst thing is when you end up in that kind of a waiting game, that you postpone that decision, because then you're it's not like you wish some external event will happen that will solve everything for you. But that seldom happens, at least exactly when you want it. So I think just to take that decision, get that alignment, people understand that we are all working for the same purpose, get the alignment, take the decision, and then just go for it and do the best possible job you can do.
Yeah.
So okay.
One more question about the insourcing strategy, and then I want to spend just a little bit of time before we wrap up talking a little bit about the clinical path, where you are, and the therapy itself. But that question would be, when you make the decision to insource and you transfer that technology from your outsourcer to your own facility, to what degree do you assume more regulatory scrutiny? Do you embrace a bigger regulatory challenge? So just kind of walk us through that. Give us a sense of what's involved there.
So obviously, when you build your own facility, first, like more short term, what it means for our company is that since the manufacturing facility will become a GMP certified facility, needs to abide by a lot more like regulations, also when it comes to quality control, standard operating procedures, all these things. And when they need to be implemented in the facility, the rest of the company is affected as well. So you need to, things that you've done previously, maybe in a quite regulated manner, only because you're a publicly traded company, you need to have certain regulations but now you need to sort of up that a level, because if the facility needs to work, you know, according to certain operating procedures and quality controls, the whole company is affected by that one. Mm-hmm. The good thing is that it will only kind of increase the standard of how we work. The potential downside that you have to be careful of is that you don't become too bureaucratic or too sort of, that you lose that kind of entrepreneurial spirit and that startup mentality that we've had. Even if we've worked for years and years, it's still very we work as a startup and like where everyone can contribute, that we are discussing a lot internally. And the more structure you put on that, there's always a risk that you become too bureaucratic. So you have to watch out for that. But otherwise, obviously, we will get more and more quality control and these kinds of aspects into the company as a whole. Then the facility obviously will need to be GMP certified to go through that check and also inspected by the EMA and FDA. So that's also on us to make sure that all these the aspects of the facility abide by those regulations that the authorities have. So it's a big, that's obviously a big thing that is usually on that external manufacturer. It's their problem. You just check that they are FDA inspected and EMA inspected and all these things. But now we need to make sure that we become.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. So let's, in the time we have remaining here, let's shift gears real quick and just get an update on the pipeline, on your clinical efforts. You know, the startup story at Diamyd is inspiring, even pre-Ulf and Julius, you know, a company inspired by a daughter's suffering with the disease. There's no one, that I'm aware of. I don't know anyone who's not affected or impacted in some way by diabetes. You know, I've got plenty of it in my family. My sister, she's a few years older than I am, and she's the recipient of a kidney transplant due to a diabetic condition. And she's suffered considerably as a result of the disease. It's pervasive. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of interest among our listeners in where things stand in the clinic. You know, what the prospects look like moving forward. So give us an update there.
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, we are now moving into phase three. So this year, we will start the phase three trial in Europe and in US. It's a pretty large trial with more than 300 individuals who are recently diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And maybe the most exciting part of that trial is that it will be what we call like a precision medicine phase three trial. So we are screening the newly diagnosed individuals, and then we are selecting the ones where we already know on beforehand have a high likelihood of benefiting from the treatment. Mm-hmm. And these are based on our previous trials where we have a lot of, like, we have an analysis where we combine more than data from more than 600 individuals who have participated in four previous trials. And those analyses quite convincingly show that there's a specific group of patients who have a specific genotype, they respond very positively to our treatment. So now when we go into phase three, we are able to only pick out those individuals, and they will be the ones who will be part of the trial. And this is obviously precision medicine in general. It's for me very exciting because I believe truly that's the future. It's already happening, but I think it's even more the future of pharmaceutical development, and we won't even be talking about precision medicine in the future. Now it's a bit of a buzzword, but it will become the common thing. You only treat the individuals where you know on beforehand have a high likelihood of benefiting. Because today there's a lot of drugs that maybe work well on 20-30%, but you treat 100%. 70% maybe don't get any benefit, right? Maybe some side effects, but those 30%, the average is good enough then to get approval. But I don't think that will be viable in the future anymore when it comes to payers and patients or physicians. Mm-hmm. And we have now a lot of data pointing to where it works and where it doesn't work. And then to do a large, hopefully pivotal trial, a final trial before market in only individuals where we believe it has a high likelihood of working. So that's very exciting. And then we have a small trial ongoing with the same asset in another indication in diabetes called LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes in adults. So it's about 10% of type 2 diabetics have an autoimmune form of diabetes, which is quite similar or very similar to type 1 diabetes. So we also see that we have a high likelihood that we would get good results there. So that's ongoing. And then we have our second asset, which is a small molecule called Remegen, which has shown in preclinical studies that it can regenerate insulin-producing cells. And we have it now in the clinic here in Sweden in individuals who have had type 1 diabetes for at least 5 years. And we are both looking at the safety, but also looking at potential efficacy to see, could we see any kind of indication that it can regenerate or improve the insulin-producing capacity? And the first results we have surprisingly show that it seems to be able to reduce the risk for hypoglycemia, which was a surprising finding, but a potential new indication for this drug as well. Mm. And then not to talk about something which it's becoming really big in type 1 diabetes, is prevention. How do you to treat healthy individuals who are at a high risk of getting the disease? We have two smaller trials in these at-risk individuals, which look very promising, again, for our specific patient population, which is genotype. And it's also something that the regulatory authorities have accepted now, that diabetes starts already before the diagnosis. It already starts when you start seeing signs of autoimmunity based on these autoantibodies. Yeah. So that's also very exciting that the field as a whole is really moving ahead now, and that we can be on the forefront of this development, I think, is very exciting.
Yeah. When you start to apply sort of biomarker filters in your clinical trials recruitment effort, does that create a challenge as far as recruitment? I mean, obviously you're looking for specific outcomes, and that's strategy. But does it create a specific challenge in terms of clinical recruitment? And if so, how do you, what does that effort look like?
Yeah. So the good thing for us is that the subgroup we are going for, it's still a pretty sizable group. It's almost half of the type 1 diabetics.
Okay.
But we will obviously need to, let's say if we want to include 300 individuals, we would at least need to screen around 600, because half of those will not be eligible, only because they don't have the right genotype. So it will be a bit more costly on the screening side. And obviously, if you want to see on the, I wouldn't say negative, but some people, okay, so you only have half the market, if you think commercially. But then we also know that we have a much higher likelihood of hitting our endpoints, because we only treat individuals where we already know they have a high likelihood of benefiting. And usually precision medicine efforts have a premium price, because payers know that most individuals will get benefit, not only certain percentage. So you have that kind of an advantage as well. Then we are looking at what's called HLA genotypes, but they are quite routinely used in, for example, the transplantation setting. So we don't have to invent any kind of new assays that could be costly and that need to be certified and validated. They already exist. So it's not becoming overly complicated for us. So we see the positives here, and we are following suit what they've done in the oncology setting, where I guess the biggest blockbusters like Keytruda, they go for these individuals who express a certain protein.
Sure.
And you see how the immuno-oncology field has advanced massive amounts. It's exciting to see how other indications are following suit now.
Yeah, very cool. Well, you've been more than gracious with your time, Dr. Hernelius. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Yeah, been a pleasure learning from you, and it's inspirational work. Again, the unmet medical need is giant, and I wish you well as you continue down the clinical journey. We'll be paying attention.
Thank you so much. Great pleasure.
Thank you. So that's Dr. Ulf Hernelius. I'm Matt Piller, and this is The Business of Biotech. We're produced by Bioprocess Online in partnership with Cytiva, which offers a trove of resources and guidance for emerging biopharmas at CytivaLifeSciences.com/emerging biotech. That's CYTIVA.com/emerging biotech. Check that out. Check us out at bioprocessonline.com. And please subscribe to my newsletter while you're there. In the meantime, before you go, give us 5 stars. And if you like what you heard, thank you for listening.